and welcome to Art Beat, a new radio show by the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands, where we discuss the latest developments in Cayman's art scene, featuring in-depth interviews with local creatives and community partners.
I'm Maya Mutu, Education Manager at the National Gallery.
I'm Jessica Ebanks, Community Engagement Coordinator at the National Gallery.
Today we're joined by Nasaria Sakou-Chalette, whose mid-career solo show, All the Coals We Left in the Fire, is currently on exhibition at the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands until October 7th. Nasaria is a visual artist, theater practitioner, and poet whose work explores themes of female strength and empowerment, race and the deconstruction of harmful racial narratives, cultural memory, and Caymanian cultural traditions. Amongst other accolades, she is a winner of the McCoy Prize for Art, a Gold Star for Creativity at the National Arts and Culture Awards, and the Bendel Hides Award winner in 2019's inaugural Cayman Islands Biennial. Nasaria, welcome, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Maya.
Yes. So you received the aforementioned Bendel Hides Award for a piece called Becoming Again.
Yes.
For those who haven't seen Becoming Again yet, can you describe that work and why you presented that for Cross Currents, the first Cayman Islands Biennial?
Okay. Becoming Again, to me, started off as sort of another iteration of work I'd done with Plant and Trash before. Thinking about this idea of trash, like what we value, how we value things, the fact that we call plant and trash trash, but if it was not in between the two pieces of cloth to make the mattress, you'd be sleeping on two thin pieces of cloth on the floor or on the wood. And so that's where that initial idea came from. And this consideration of the fact that things have to disintegrate and be sacrificed in order for new growth to come. And this is where the idea to do an old-time plant and trash bed came from. I used clear plastic because I wanted the quote-unquote trash to actually be focused, the focus. I wanted to have its shining moment, right? And I'll tell you that initially I had done that piece and I had done it, you know, a couple of, maybe a foot and a half off the ground. And I got it to the gallery, and I looked at it in a space, and I was like, no. And I grabbed it back out, went back and went to Kerwin, was helping me, Kerwin Ebanks. And I said, we have to lift this up. It needs to come up. I think it made the difference, because what it helped me to communicate is that looking at those things that we had that were just a part of our daily living, and obviously a part of women's work, but like raising it up from the mundane to something that is more holy, to be considered more important in our history. And that was what was important about that piece for me.
Yeah, I think the fact that it is raised up makes it very visually impactful as well.
Yeah.
And when you walk into a space, it's not a piece that you can miss.
Right.
In this current show, it's kind of in that central room in the middle of our lower exhibition space. And it is very central. You
yeah.
can see it very well. But even when it was upstairs in our national collection space, it was in a corner by a window. And
right.
even then, even in a corner, you uh-huh. know, it was... It's still something that very much catches your eye because
right.
it is raised to that higher level and it's by mm-hmm. the window where the light's kind of cascading.
Right,
in,
yeah. And really the leaves from the outside or the light is like flashing on it, so it makes it come alive even more, and the light changes throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So I found that to be very interesting. It's almost like a different piece each time you go in. And in terms of raising it up, talking about the wood, a lot of it was found like on the shore, had been in the water. That has something to me, you know, in terms of our shipping history and those type of things. And also the some of the wood is burnt.
Mm.
And once again, something being sacrificed, a tree was sacrificed for the wood, which was burnt, which was now sacrifice to become a part of something new. And I think all of that comes together in that piece.
Yeah, I think it gives it a very elemental quality with kind of having the wood and then the light coming in from the window and that
uh-huh.
kind of, you know, the burnt wood too. So you have this fire aspect and it's
right.
got all of these different kind of ephemeral elemental elements coming
yeah.
together.
Yeah. And it reminds me a little bit of like a Hindu funeral pyre.
Mm.
That was the other thing that I didn't plan. And that's one thing I want to say about art. It's like it teaches us what it wants to be, even after we have, quote unquote, created it. Because when I walked in and I saw it at that height, that's what I saw. I didn't necessarily think of that before I did it, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting because you have what the art itself is telling you to make, but then the space is so important too,
yes.
Right? The actual physical location of where that piece is going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about the light and the reflection of the leaves.
Right.
Which adds so much more to the story of that,
yes,
that work as
right.
well. Right.
And then even in this exhibition, having it in the middle of the room and not a lot more around it. So each wall around it has one or two pieces on it, but it's not overflowing. So it gives it space so you can consider the piece and really experience it. And I thought that was really nice. Recently, while giving a tour, somebody asked me, so where'd you get the wood from? You know, this burnt wood. I was like, my neighbor's son burnt his house to the ground, so I ran over and grabbed it. That was about 7 years ago, maybe even more. So you see how things can interest us, and it doesn't tell you what it wants to be. It doesn't become a part of anything for many years after.
Mm.
But I'm a bit of a hoarder, I will admit.
Well, speaking of drawing things out of the embers, that's the perfect segue into my next question.
Good.
So, of course, the winner of the Bendel Hides Award is granted a solo exhibition at the National Gallery, and that was partly the genesis of this current show. And I think the title is a good place to go to next.
Mm-hmm.
The title of this show is All the Coals We Left in the Fire. What does that mean? Why did you select this title for the show?
Right. My work is seeking to excavate things. I want to, like, pull up that rug and sweep what's under there out. That's the whole idea. And that's what my work has been doing, but in small sort of bits throughout my career. I don't think we've ever seen, like, a room full of what I've done before. And so even for me, it was absolutely overwhelming. And amazing to see it all come together. So those coals, those things that we don't always want to talk about, I want to talk about mental health. I want to talk about the past of slavery, but then also the inheritance, the amazing inheritance of Africa. I want to talk about these things that people are slightly uncomfortable with, because right now, in almost every part of the world, there's something happening that people don't want to talk about. We never seem to learn the lesson that if we don't look at it, we will just continue to make those mistakes, and we're just holding all that stuff in. And what is the shame in being enslaved? It's not as if you were born to be a slave, and it's not as if you caused that history on yourself. It was a part of it. If somebody has mental health issues, they're not going to get better by pretending they don't exist. I'm also looking in ways at death, and just probably my own reactions or thoughts about death as you get older, as perhaps you lose other people, as maybe, you know, you have challenges yourself, then you begin to consider those things. So those coals are still in the fire. Even if we ignore them, they're not going out. And that was the reason for the title.
Yeah. I think many of us have been considering some of these things, particularly over the past 2 years, and obviously not limited to that time frame. But as so much upheaval has been going on in the world,
people
are more and more talking about how essential it is to have these conversations,
right,
and to dredge up things that people like to leave hidden,
mm-hmm,
right? Because how do we progress into a future that takes care of all of us,
right,
without addressing those things?
Exactly.
Right?
And that is the issue, making sure that our community and our society is about taking care of everyone. And that there should not be the need for the word the disenfranchised. You know, there needs to be an equalizing type of movement right now.
Right, yeah. So you mentioned earlier that this show is a collection of pieces from different time periods. So it presents kind of a combination of new work and older work,
mm-hmm.
the most recent being from this year, of course, so the Alchemy series, Bloodlines, Crackerjack, and then some of the earliest, I think I tried to look into this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the earliest would be The Women Have Become the Truth from 2005.
I agree.
How did you select the work that was going to be exhibited in this show with quite a large catalog?
Well, it was difficult to select because I know my work can be overwhelming. So I'm not painting daisies and, you know, palm trees and those type of things. I'm not creating works about things that are easy on the emotional system, let's just say. And so I knew, and in talking with Will, it really helped at the gallery. Sorry, what's Will's last name?
Calfrecht. Yeah.
Will. She said his name. So in talking with him, one of the initial conversations we had about this, you know, he did say to me, don't put too many pieces in. Keep the opens. I'm so happy that we did it because each piece is getting to, like, live its own life. And I know that the first piece I chose was The Women Have Become the Truth because I consider it one of my strongest pieces of work. And to have been done from way back then, I think it was sort of my indication to myself that, yeah, I can keep doing this. Like, being an artist is something that I can actually do because I knew within myself that piece was immensely strong. And considering I sold it to a fellow artist of mine who then 3 years later I saw it was in his trunk. And I said, why is my work in your trunk? And he said, it's just too much for me. It was like too much for him. So I got it back from him and sold it to the National Collection. Of course, I paid him back what he paid me. But that was the indicator to me that this is like a very strong piece. It needs to be in the National Collection for the people. That would be very important. In terms of the rest of the works, there were a lot of pieces. Another part of Coal that we left in the fire, additions to collections that I had never done. Like this, I'd done three in this series and thought, I should do these two more, never got around to it or started the canvas and it just sat there. So it was also a way for me to sort of complete this time period for me. And I've done it. I'm happy to say that there's no residual stuff and so now it's going forward. It's sort of like a cleaner slate to start with to see what happens next.
Closing out that cycle.
Yes.
So I want to keep talking about The Women Have Become the
yes.
Truth because I think it might be the one piece in the show that isn't sort of explicitly tied to the Caymanian context.
Mm-hmm.
That piece was inspired by the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in South Africa in 1996 after the end of apartheid. So tell us a little bit more about where that work came from and how it kind of fits into a show that's very largely anchored in this more local experience.
Right. And I'll let you know that that's the first piece I ever put myself in, and it was many, many years, I think up to between then and 2020 before I put myself in my work again. So that's a whole other conversation. I watched the Peace and Reconciliation hearings, and what struck me, and for people who don't know what that is, after apartheid had been abolished, instead of seeking, quote-unquote, retribution on the men who had killed, murdered, raped, those who were, like, working for the government, and obviously they have instructions, this is what you need to do, instead of throwing them all in jail, what happened was that Mandela decided to have hearings where the families affected would come and bear witness to what happened. And then those, mostly men, were then made responsible for those who are left behind financially, mm-hmm. for their education, for just, you know, those type of things. And what happened was all the people that showed up to these hearings to bear witness were old women and children. And a lot of the children had gone mute because they had seen their parents killed. And so the women have become the truth. The only ones to speak about what had happened were these older women. And I thought at that time, I really thought, it's amazing because I wanted revenge. You know, I thought everybody should be thrown in jail. And I thought, how amazing to have that within you, that goodness within you to say, more bloodshed, more death, more hardship is only going to cause our country to have more and more and more negative energy, right? Now, did it work is the question, because South Africa is still in so much upheaval and lands haven't been returned. And but I still stand by my understanding at that time that was a better, it was sort of like a higher road to take. But that road, I understand, can't always be taken in order to have change. And that piece, in terms of it being the one piece that doesn't fit exactly into the Cayman heritage and culture, what happened and why I put myself in that, that's the Caymanian part of it, is that it is me, because I literally watched those hearings and felt every iota of emotion as if I were them. And that painting just flowed out of me. There was, you know, when you're painting, you're creating, you know, little things go quote-unquote wrong. You're thinking to yourself, that's wrong, or that's a mistake, or I don't like that. This just flowed. It just, like, I just threw up on that canvas. I did it on baby diaper material because of that desire to bring some comfort to the whole situation. And there's hope in it. There's still hope in that image. But the Caymanian part is my connection to it, as that's when I first started learning about a lot of our African heritage and those type of things. My connection to those women is if I am them and they are me.
Right. And it's placed in a really nice place in the exhibition then, because it's right next to the title wall.
Yes.
Which of course, and then of course your biography sectional as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're here with Nasaria Sokou-Shalet talking about All the Coals We Left in the Fire. Our conversation will continue after these messages.
The National Gallery of the Cayman Islands is open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and admission is always free. We are located on the Esterly-Tibbetts Highway just before the Kamana Bay Roundabout and can also be accessed via Harkvale Drive off Lawrence Boulevard. Visit our website at nationalgallery.org.ky or call us at 345-945-8111 to learn more.
Register your child for the National Gallery's free after-school art program, Walker's Art Club. Walker's Art Club is an inclusive program that welcomes students of all abilities from age 5 to 17. Make new friends from different schools, develop technical art skills, learn more about Cayman's culture, and express yourself through creativity. Registration opens on Friday, the 19th of August at 9 a.m. Visit nationalgallery.org.ky to submit your form and learn more.
Join our membership program and be in the know. By signing up as a National Gallery member, you'll help fund free education and outreach programs, exhibitions, and free admission, ensuring that everyone in our community has access to the arts. Make a difference in your community by becoming a member and enjoy our members-only benefits, including special events, discounts, and more. Sign up online at nationalgallery.org.ky/memberships.
Welcome back to Artbeat with the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to multidisciplinary artist Nasaria Sokou-Shalet about her art practice and current solo exhibition, All the Coals We Left in the Fire, which is currently on display at the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands. Is it fair to call you multidisciplinary artist? I think so.
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to say that I had many different personalities, but how you're saying it is much nicer. So.
Okay, so a few of the works in this show have been exhibited before, but they've been reimagined in this exhibition. So I'm thinking about Out in the Wash, which you exhibited as part of 2020's Island of Women, and then Blue Black, which was shown in 2021's Reimagined Futures, and then I believe again during Art Week, the first edition of Art Week. Tell me about how those works evolved and why.
Mm-hmm. Oh, those are two heavy hitters, too. I'll start with Out in the Wash. So for those who haven't seen the show, they're a collection of old metal bath pans. Two of them have been used before. It was very important for me to sort of go around and beg people their old bath pans because I wanted them to have lived lives. And when I first heard about the women in Georgetown who used to they used to wash for the more affluent people maybe along South Sound area, right? And they would gather in a central area in Georgetown, probably, I think it was close to farmers, and they would wash together. So they all had different clients, but they would come together and wash the clothes. And I started to think about all the talking that they did and that this was community coming together. This was a space for women to be in communion with each other, to share their woes, but also their joys. And also, I started to think about all the things they learned about those people that were washing clothes for that they would have found in the pockets, the things they would have found in the pockets that would indicate secrets that they might not share with anybody else, like a true insight into what their life was like compared to the life that these women were living. Right? And these women were living their life out loud. I mean, the women who told me about this are some of the most vibrant people. They are just like, joy is loud, anger is loud, everything is loud, right? And I love it. They're so alive. And so for this iteration of Out in the Wash, I really wanted to focus a little bit more on that aspect. And so we recorded some short skits that I had written that would tie back to the objects that I put in the water. So there are objects that are in the water that are connected to these stories. Little things they found in the pockets, what they surmised from it. Could even be like evidence of a past murder, or it could be something as simple as this person's writing stories and wants to be a writer, which would have been unusual for a young lady in that time. Or it might be somebody terminated a pregnancy and the truth is in what they found in the pocket, maybe a bottle of pills, which they would know what it was used for. And so these elements are in the water, and the water for me is like, once again, making things holy or baptizing them, because looking once again at women's work and how community comes together around that. And so you hear these voices in the background that are talking about all these things, just as they would be talking together in reality. I've also put a rag rug on the ground there, like to encourage people to even kneel, to even pay reverence to those elements, because it's our amazing history of make do is what created our very rich heritage.
Mm-hmm. And a kind of wider regional history and heritage of storytelling and oral tradition, right?
Yes.
I almost embarrassed myself on the radio because if you're standing very close to this piece, you can hear the recordings very easily, and you can hear the stories that Nasaria has written and the recordings of them. But if you're sitting sort of at our reception desk or maybe in the gift shop, you can kind of hear just snippets here and there. Uh-huh. And I almost just quoted one of the snippets, but I'm not going to embarrass myself on the radio because not this time. Maybe for the next interview.
Be careful. Yeah. Right? Put that one under the rug a little bit.
No, yes, yeah, that one is being swept. Back under the rug, right under the rag rug.
Yeah.
So selfishly, I do. Actually, let's talk about blue-black before I go on to the next
question.
Well,
further to the pans as well, the wash pans, is that the things that they contain in them, and as I said, they're tied to these stories, right? But what's really important to me in my work as well is having other people from other cultures walk in and connect to the pan. So that has been amazing. In most of my work, it has happened, and several times it surprised me. I was like, you're from the Appalachian Mountains, and you had what? Just like us. So it's connecting us, right? As for Blue Black, that one very specifically, I attend they call it the Old Timers Gathering at Mr. Rennie Barnes' house, and I remember one of the ladies talking about that each district had a different name for the other. We haven't been able to figure out Bodden Towns and Northside yet. But EastEnders were called Cox and Grouper, which I think referred to them like loving fish, only eating fish. And since I am technically from East End originally, I can concur. There's a lot of fish eating in East End. And then West Bayers were called Conk Bubby, which some West Bayers think it's just because they ate a lot of conk. some people think it's like this reference, because you know those little feelers on the conch, they kind of don't do much, and there's this idea that people have, which is not true, by the way. Some of my West Bay students were their comedy is so smart that I couldn't even put them in detention. They would have me cracking up. So, but it's this idea that idea about West Bears, which might have been the reason for it. And then this woman, who's very dark-skinned, says to me, yes, and Georgetowners was Inkstopper. And I was like, Inkstopper, what's that? And she said, with a little laugh, she said, you know, when you put the cork in the ink bottle, how it come out black, that's an Inkstopper. And that's when I realized that the reference of Inkstopper had to do with their skin color, right? And just the fact that she said it, at first I was perturbed. She said it and laughed. So I was like, why are you laughing? That's so obviously racist. And then another time I was thinking about it, I was like, but she has not let it touch her. And that is also a strength that I think is amazing. 'Cause she very well knew what it was. So I wanted to humanize these Inkstoppers. I've always been collecting bottles. I think right after Ivan, the waters must have gone like deep down into the cliff rocks and pulled up these bottles, because you couldn't burn bottles on heat. So a lot of them get thrown up the cliff or just thrown in this area in the ground, a hole in the ground or something. And they all started to come up, and they're old glass. They're thick. They don't have proper markings on them. And I remembered like the Rade-Aid bottle. Like, it's so recognizable. Like, everybody knows that's Rade-Aid if you know Rade-Aid, right? So I've been collecting them for a long time, and that's what I decided to do, was to put these corks into these bottles, fill them up with colored water, and then put heads on them to humanize them, to say those Inkstoppers that you were talking about were human beings with like so much richness in them and should not have been disrespected in that way. And in each iteration, I look at a different element of who they were, you know, perhaps their spirituality or the idea of, you know, the red being the blood that we all have, the black bottles being like the African heritage that we should be proud of, and the blue water being like the sea that we travel on to come here. But also, it's a reference back to original religions, which were stripped away during the time of slavery, like, for instance, Yoruban practices, Orisha, where spirits of ancestors were caught in bottles and hung on trees so that you could call upon them when you needed them. I wanted to honor that as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. It's all coming together for me now.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. So in this iteration of this piece of work, I focus mostly on Yemaya, the deity that was sometimes called Mamawati, or goddess of the ocean, river, sea, that type of thing. And that's why all the elements on the ground behind it would be the things that we found in the sea, which I actually found in the sea myself.
And this is in Yoruba spirituality?
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Or Shango. I mean, it has different names, Santeria, and Mamawati's name changes depending on what Caribbean island you're from, but it definitely came over with us from Africa.
So I want to talk about the Carnival Duppies series.
Yes.
A little bit selfishly, because it's my favorite series in the show.
Oh, nice.
So tell us a little bit about it. You spoke a little bit earlier about your interest in talking about mental health through this, through the work of the show as well.
I've always, from the time I was a child, I've always been the type of person where the person that nobody else wants to talk to, that's who I want to friend up, right? Because I just think that people should be treated with dignity no matter what. And for me, Carnival Duppies, the carnival part is that we see people all the time walking the streets who obviously have mental issues, and we enjoy the spectacle of them. We make fun with them. Then there's a difference between making fun with them and of them. But of them happens as well. People make fun of them, or they make fun with them. And I think that making fun with them is an attempt to treat them just like you or me. But sometimes it can be it reads differently for other people. What we have to consider is that they are human beings, and there's things happening inside that they may not be able to communicate. So we don't know if they're living in fear. We don't know if they realize that their reality is altered and that they're fighting to come back. But what we see is this garbled talk that we're looking at. Some people think, just say, oh, well, he's on drugs. But what caused him or her to go on drugs is usually a mental health issue that has not been dealt with, right? And so therefore they try to self-medicate to regulate themselves. And so the spectacle part is that, and that's why in the paintings I have these women with these, you know, headdresses that look almost carnivalesque. But at the same time, the Duffy part is, do we see them? Do we really see them, or are they just the spectacle? That's all we see. Do we see the human inside? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and the interesting thing about carnival, of course, is that the word carnival comes from sort of saying farewell to the flesh, right? It's
right.
Like a removal from your physical being and more of a focus on the spirit kind of within your body and removing yourself from any of the social sort of mores around you or
right.
social position that you're meant to be in. So it's an interesting word to explore that idea of people who are more than just what they appear to be on the surface.
Right. Exactly. And then also in those headdresses, it's not just for spectacle, but sometimes for me, it's all the gifts that they have that we might never receive because they're unable to communicate them. Like, everybody comes with a purpose, and because of what has happened to them, they may not get to express those. And we are the ones who are poorer for it, right?
Mm. Yeah, there's such vibrancy in those paintings. They are very, very colorful pieces. And there's one piece which kind of has almost like a black background and then pieces of yo-yo quilting almost kind
right.
of coming from the figure's head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's all of this, there's so much richness in there and so much information
right.
and stories that are in this person's mind and this
right.
person's being that maybe we don't see or appreciate all the
right.
time.
Right, exactly. And that one is the most recent in that series, and it was done on the black reflective enamel paint because I want the viewer to see themselves reflected in it, because it's important to know that there just one incident is all it takes for one of us to be in that same position, right? The mind is fragile at times.
So, turning pages a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you have a very collaborative approach to your work. And that's not just in terms of sort of receiving inspiration for the work or getting feedback from other people about the work, but actually in terms of the very material process of creating that work.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what that collaborative process looks like for you, and how does working with other people kind of shape what the final work looks
mm-hmm.
like?
I think that probably comes from my theater background, because, you know, theater's not going to happen with two people.
Yeah.
It's much easier to be an artist, I will admit, to be a visual artist, because you don't have to rely on everybody else to make it happen. But for me, one of the reasons for the collaborative way that I work is that I want to feature the fine craft techniques and skills in my work, and there is nobody who's better at it than the person who's been doing it for 70 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I really enjoy the process of going. So I will come up, like, an idea comes to me, right? And I'll think to myself, who does that? And who would love to be a part of this? Because some people are not comfortable having their work in the gallery and things like that. And I would approach them and explain to them the idea. And a lot of times, because my work is more contemporary, but it's using those techniques, they end up looking at me like, you come in here with another crazy idea, you know, like that. But then they have, there's a little joy in them. And they love that I'm coming to them. And I love being schooled by them. Like, a lot of times they're like, no, you don't do it like that. Or you hung this wrong, which, by the way, there is a piece in the gallery that I made a mistake and put something on backwards, which I have to rectify. And I was told by Miss Carmen herself, sorry, you put that on wrong. And I love that, because I'm still learning. I'm still at their knee, basically, asking them to tell me stories. And so they become a part of the story that I'm telling. And they help to carve the narrative that I'm telling because they have the experience. And I'm having the vision. Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing, and I want to keep doing it forever. And so honored to have that piece of work. I was looking at the piece, alchemy, the piece with the zinc, which is rusted but then has been filled in with crochet and then an embroidered piece of cloth. And I'm thinking to myself, my auntie did that for me. You know, she's in her 80s. This is something that I value so much to have. Thank you, auntie. And so it's also for me building memories for when people are no longer with us, we have those beautiful things to look at and to remember them through.
Yeah, the show is really about community in so many ways, and that collaborative approach, I think, really reflects that.
Right. Yeah. And then I also like to include younger generations. We have quite a lot. My husband and I have a lot of teenagers or young 20-year-olds, that area, who we've taught before, had interactions with before, who have gone away with maybe some of the things we said to them and come back and said, now I realize how much you all know or how much I've missed, and I want to know more. And they're coming back to get more of the history and culture. And to include them in it, too, is to honor them taking a different road, that they're not just working to get clothes to go to the club on Friday. That they're, I mean, that's fine if you want to do that. But they're doing more. There's more purpose in them. And it's quite an honor to be able to sit and talk with them.
Amazing. Okay, we'll be back with Nasaria Sakushalet after these messages. As part of our art and wellness program, and in partnership with the Alex Panton Foundation's Youth Ambassadors Program, the National Gallery hosts free art drop-ins for teenagers aged 14 to 18. Join us on the final Saturday of each month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. Take part in collaborative art projects, socialize with peers, or enjoy mindful creative time in a safe space. For more information, contact us at program@nationalgallery.org.ky or call 345-945-8111. Looking for a unique gift? The National Gallery's gift shop has a wide variety of locally made jewelry and fine crafts, art prints, books, kids' items, and more. Express your creativity through our inspired selection of fine goods and one-of-a-kind pieces. Each purchase from the gift shop helps to support the National Gallery's public programs and free admission. The gift shop is open Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. All the Coals We Left in the Fire, a mid-career solo exhibition of work by Nasaria Sakushalet, is on view at the National Gallery until October 7th. Shalet's work offers a deep and multi-layered consideration of Caymanian history, including those aspects of our shared experience that have often been overlooked or even buried. Admission to All the Coals We Left in the Fire is free, Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Donations appreciated. This exhibition is kindly sponsored by Butterfield. We are back on Art Beat with the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands, and I'm here with Nasaria Sakushalet, and we're talking about her show at the National Gallery, which is called All the Coals We Left in the Fire, open until the 7th of October. I am curious, is there a piece in this show that you found really challenging to make?
I have to think about that. I do recall being very frustrated, but I need to pull up. Oh, yes. And these are pieces that the womb basket installation, those pieces have been difficult for several different reasons. The first reason is that I had sort of, I wanted originally all three of the baskets, which are in the shape of different stages of pregnancy. So there's one that's, you know, second trimester, one is first, and then one is you have twins when you have twins in the stomach. And the idea came from looking at a seed pod and thinking how beautiful it is with these. So, you know, the little, I don't know what it is, but it keeps the seeds in place in the middle, the sort of membrane-y type stuff. So I use lace for that instead. So those pieces were difficult because I tried to collaborate with someone to do them all as thatch, plaited thatch baskets. And it was difficult for them to to figure it out. So then they had to give me back the stuff. So then I had to find somebody else, and then time was getting short. So I did manage to get Miss Rose May to do one of the baskets. We had enough time for her to do one. And then I had to figure out other materials to use because I can't thatch, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but in the end, it actually turned out to be like a really good happenstance because I rag-rugged one, which gave this, the one with the twins, which gave this amazing sort of comforting, once again, using the diaper material, this idea of comfort in that one. And then I blinged one completely out, which I thought would really connect with the younger generation, right? And apparently it has. Apparently a lot of people have come in and be like, I like that one.
Yeah,
right?
I've heard students say that on tours as they've come in. Yeah. I was smiling behind the mic because you can't see her right now, obviously, because we're on the radio. But our community engagement coordinator, Jessica, is also on the other side of the mic. And she was saying to me yesterday that she's been collecting these seed pods. And she found a seed pod that kind of looked like a flower.
Right.
And when she got it home, it had closed up. So because it had kind of shrunken in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just making me think of when you're pregnant, your body, your whole body chemistry changes,
mm-hmm.
right? Like things that you never even knew existed in your body before all of a sudden
right.
exist. And it, things can shrink and contract. And it's just the incredibleness, if that's a word,
right.
Of the fact that the body is nature. And just the magic of what women's bodies can do.
Right. And then one of my favorite seed pods is actually the Nika pod, which is like so prickly. You know, it's really hard to touch. But then if you can get inside it, you've got like two or three Nikas and there's like a reward. And I think it actually is a metaphor for our entire culture, I think, that we can be very prickly people. But once you get into the heart of us, there's like so much warmth there and beauty there. We just have to be protective. We've learned that, right? One of the other things about doing the womb basket that has been difficult is like when I first did it, I didn't want to like get involved with the emotions of making those baskets, right? And so I didn't put anything in the description that had to do with what it has now become, which is women connecting to the work who have lost children. And it's once again my art telling me what it's supposed to be. So sometimes, because I'm intuitive, the idea comes through me, but I may not at that time understand exactly what it's going to be. And I remember one guest coming in to see the show and looking at the white, the rag rugged one, and seeing a little pink spot and just breaking down into tears. And so it has become that these baskets are sort of remembrances, but not to bring a lot of woe, but to bring comfort. And so the idea is that for the time that you have had the child within you, whatever period of time that is, that was life and that you had it and that for whatever reason, it's not going to be in this world right now. But you still have something, and never think of your womb or your basket as empty. It's full. It's full of memories, and it's full of movement, and it's full of connection. And nothing's going to take that period of time away. So I think that's what's important. And so I've actually just written a poem to sort of extend that idea. And also I do believe that's going to become a much bigger installation in the future.
Mm. There is a lot about healing in this show.
Yeah.
And in addition to the womb baskets, I also think about the alchemy series, which uses a lot of embroidery and patchwork as kind of a metaphor for healing in some ways. Is there a piece in the show, kind of the other side of my earlier question, that you found particularly healing to make yourself?
Healing to make. Let me think about that for a second. Ah, yes. In terms of a piece that's in the show that's healing to me, it is it's the longest title, I think, in the show. All the things we brought with us beyond the door of no return. I was doing the idea of alchemy, right, is taking something that's masculine and something that's feminine, which represents the household, and in back in the days when we were sort of developing and looking at how those things, those two things come together to create a family and sustain a family. But for the women, it's always about healing. So while the men may build the houses, when something goes wrong inside, the women would patch it up. And when your clothing got old, they would patch it up. There was a sense of pride about clothing. And so we healed the family. We were always about mending things and making do in this magical way. And so I started this piece off just in that conversation, which is quite a big conversation. And I had this metal grid. It's an iron grid, quite heavy. And I decided that to juxtapose that with the softness of this white, just totally white rag rugged practice, that there's something about it, because there's this diaphragm material and all, and then there's this rusty metal, right? And it sort of reminds me of the combination of my grandfather and my grandmother, or other grandfathers and grandmothers. And I'm not saying that the rusty metal was the man necessary, because sometimes it can be the woman, right? And I got to a certain point where I only had like a small window of maybe like 7 by 5 inches rectangle that I needed to fill in. And I stood up and stepped back from the piece, and I could not go any further with it, because it had become exactly what it was supposed to be. It reminded me so much of something, and I started Googling and I checked. And what it reminded me of is the door of no return in Ghana, where it would be the last thing of Africa, really, that the enslaved Africans would see before they got onto the ship. And there's this big white wall that goes like right down the side, like it meets and becomes a part of the side of the cliff. And I think that the ship must have come right up there, and there's a plank that you walk out on. And it's this metal grid of a door. It has bars on it. And that piece for me, to have that sort of happen like that, I couldn't do anymore. I knew it had to stay the way it is, and I knew that we needed to hang it the way that it's hung in the gallery now, which is out from the wall and casting shadows and having this feeling of this heaviness of hanging. And for me, the reason that was healing for me is because when you're preparing for a show like this, I did quite a number of new works, even though we used some older works. And it was tiring, and at points I didn't know if I could continue. And this piece, and then I didn't know if everybody wanted to see this. Like, would everybody want to see all my work in one room? What would happen? And this piece for me said, what is coming through you is what you have to trust. And so that is why that was, the most pivotal moment in producing the work. And it's really the first piece I finished, although I was doing other pieces alongside it.
Yeah. I was looking at pictures of the Door of No Return myself, and it's almost a very visceral experience when you,
yes.
I mean, you're not even physically being there, but just looking at images on the internet of this place, and there's this kind of dark tunnel that's a very enclosed space that leads out towards this door that you described, and then just the ocean. And it's a very intense experience just looking at that image and understanding what that was and what that led to for so many people. And then the work, the alchemy work, is, I think you get that sort of feeling of intensity, but there's also this kind of softness to it that feels comforting. Like you said, the softness of that rag rug fabric. That piece is also quite near to a window, so it is getting a little bit of light in there as well. And just this sort of like almost floating quality that it has. It feels more airy than I think the actual, looking at that actual image of the Door of No Return, which is full of so much grief and heaviness.
Right.
This piece really does sort of counter that in an interesting way.
Yeah.
What is your hope for your work in the public arena? What do you hope that people take from it?
Well, I know one of the things that happened, you know, there was a lady who came to see the show and she said to me, so I'm finally getting to see all your work together and now I get it, because before I thought you were just hopping around from one thing to the next, right? And I remember I laughed and I said, well, I'm glad that you figured it out, but I always knew what I was doing. But I think that what is important about it is that I do have, I use a variety of different medium. I'm not tied to any one specific technique. I'm not in a box, but that you can see my DNA in every single piece, and that people get it now that this collection I've been building has been a life's collection. And I think that's important for them to see. It's important for me to see it all in a room. I mean, I knew it, but how can I see it until it's all there? And that's what I want people to understand, is that an artist's journey is very personal, but at the same time, it is our connection to the audience that also helps us to even interpret our own work. And so that's what's important about audiences coming out and supporting and asking questions and bringing their experiences to the work. They're enriching me when they're telling me what they're getting out of it as well. So it's not like a one-way street. The other thing I would love to share with people before, you know, we close off is that it's very important for Caymanians to understand that the gallery belongs to them, and that you should be coming out to shows. You should be on the gallery's like invitation list, which you can do just by getting a membership. It's a small fee and it's for an entire year, and then you'll just get all the emails about everything. Or watch Instagram or Facebook. But it's important for us to come out because it's for us. The works are being bought and for the National Collection for us, for our younger generations, and it's free. There's absolutely no reason why every Caymanian has not walked through the gallery yet, or the museum, or gone to the CNCF or something. We really need to do that. And the other thing that we need to remember is that artists are doing their work, and their work is valuable. And that it's important to know that we have to support artists in that way as well, that we have to have Caymanian collectors, that all our work can't be bought by people who are going to take it to another country, because then it will no longer be here. And that a lot of the artists that I know, we always make it easy for Caymanian buyers to purchase work. You know, we've worked with people and said, okay, you can pay this now. Installments. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, installments and those type of things. But it also tells us that you value us. That, you know, you might spend this amount of money on a car, but you're telling me you can't, like, support an artist? And always to remember because a lot of times people say, oh, you know, art is expensive, and I don't, you know, we don't go to doctors and say, please save my life, and tell them if we can, like, really get, like, 50% off. So we need to really understand that we should be valuing these things, and understand that artists, we are the ones who are examining what's going on within the psyche of the community, and we're really healing through our work. And so look at us as important members of society. If you do not have artists, you're going to have so many other problems happening, right? So that's my little plug.
Thank you. You did my job for me. I don't even have to say that. Ms. Arya, thank you for joining us on today's episode of Art Beats. It's been a pleasure, as always. Nasaria's solo exhibition, All the Coals We Left in the Fire, is on at the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands until October 7th. The gallery is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Admission is free and donations are greatly appreciated. We will see you on the next episode of Art Beat, Saturdays, 10 a.m. on Bobo.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Art Beat, a show by the National Gallery of the Cayman Islands. Tune in next week for another conversation on Caymanian art. And until then, visit us at the National Gallery from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Saturday, where admission is always free.